5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
All right, that's pretty good. That's the best one yet.
Pizza, pizza.
Don't be hating on my household attire, okay? I don't go to Walmart like this.
Showtime!
While you were making egg foo young in the kitchen, I was in the dining room having sushi.
It's a little thing tech show, and that's a fact. If you don't like the cast, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that'll link it bad. For the strongman, go to like the DLNGS.org. And ICChallengeAnalytics.net. Bound tech show. Just sit right there, cause the cast is just about to begin.
Welcome to episode 871 of the Linux Link Tech Show. On the show tonight, we have Pat.
How's it going, man?
We have Joel.
Good evening.
We have Joe.
Hello.
And to start off, I want to bring up an old topic that I think we may have touched on, but it used to be something we used to talk about a lot. And in collaboration with the fact that this week at work, what I have done personally is we have migrated to a new group of Google Kubernetes clusters. These are public clusters to hopefully alleviate a problem that we're seeing in the East 4 region that's caused issues for us, particularly in our production environment. But in conjunction with doing that, we utilize Helm. Has anyone here worked with Helm? Helm.sh is the website.
Nope.
No.
It is a tool for managing and easily deploying containers. It works in conjunction with Kubernetes. Kubectl, Helm have templates. You could either define the templates in Helm, you define them written in JSON or YAML, and then Helm takes those templates you've written and converts them to calls into the Kubernetes API to deploy your applications. So we have primarily for our use on my team, there's three different kind of templates that we have utilized. One is a standard deployment template for a Node.js application. One is a cron job, which deploys out a cron job into the Kubernetes cluster. And another one is just a job. Now, the difference between a cron job and a job, obviously, is, you know, cron job is something that you set up to run on a periodic basis, whether it's, for instance, our video feed application, which goes out and grabs an RSS feed from certain specific organizations that provide us with video files and slurps them down. That runs every like 5 minutes. And then to our compaction job that would run like once a day at night. And so what that does in Kubernetes is it spins up a container, runs the job, and then it's over, and then it does it just like a cron job. And then a job is like a cron job. It runs a job, but it runs it on demand, and it doesn't, once it completes, it's over. It's finished. So you're good and done. Now, I upgraded us. We were on Helm 2.11. The latest version of Helm is 2.16.10. So I migrated us to 2.16.8. Well, first off, we used to have a script that ran this. Now it runs inside a container. For our deployment job, we run the Alpine Helm container that, instead of having to have Helm installed on our Jenkins workers, we just pull that container and run it that way. Boom, knocks out the applications into the clusters as we need them. But then, you know, from upgrading from Helm 2 to 16, and then the next step is going to Helm 3, The Helm 3 has some major changes. One of the things that Helm used to have is something called Tiller, which was a container that ran inside of your namespace. And when you would deploy using Helm, it would work with Tiller to make sure it had the necessary permissions and everything, and would keep track of the application deployments and releases as they were in the environment. They have foregone and gotten rid of Tiller in place of just using standard Kubernetes RBAC and secrets for storing the release information in the cluster, which is great, because anytime that you had to work with Tiller in the past or Helm, you would either have to set the environmental variable Tiller namespace to your namespace, or you would have to supply the namespace with every command. So it's kind of a bit of a pain in the ass. But now with Tiller, with Helm 3, you don't need to do that. So it makes it a whole much easier. Now, where my nitpicky thing comes in is, obviously, as you upgrade, and as we're upgrading our Kubernetes clusters and APIs in there, there are changes that happen to the API, to the Helm charts, different versions. And so I'm working on Helm 2, and everything's working fine, and then I test out Helm 3, shit don't work, right? It starts complaining about certain things, like it says, I don't recognize this statement or this key in the YAML file. And I go looking through documentation for the Helm upgrade, migrating from 2 to 3, and it doesn't say anything about API compatibilities. Nothing at all. It says you can change version 1 to 2, but there's still backwards compatibility with version 1. So it's little things like that get annoying. So then I have to go into the Kubernetes API, and I have to dig through their documentation to find out on version 1.16, which is the API that we're using now, for some reason, and I don't know why, when we switch from Helm 2 to Helm 3, something like what's called readiness probe, all lowercase letters, has all of a sudden changed to readiness probe, where the P is capital. And I didn't change API versions, I just changed Helm version, and now all of a sudden it won't accept the old way, it has to be the new way. Like little stupid things like that would be nice if they would document that a little more clearly. Which brings me back to way back, one of the biggest complaints that we always had, or I've always kind of had with when we first started the show, and one of the reasons why we kind of started the show and did a lot of tech-heavy stuff and tutorials at the beginning, is when you're first learning Linux, it can be daunting. Now, you have a wealth of information at your fingertips in any Linux distribution via the man pages or the info pages, but when you get down to it, somebody who's never, like, coming to this from the first time, a man page, not really helpful.
No.
You know, an info page, a little more helpful, but it's just always been that separation of documentation to bridge the gap between the novice and intermediary users and the expert users.
Right.
And, you know, eventually, after 2 decades of using it, a man page is pretty adequate. You know, you pick up things along the way. But what I notice a lot of times, especially with newer applications, when you look, and Google is like, Google big time, I have this problem with Google all the time, is you look at their documentation and you get like a quick start of, well, you got to enable these roles, and then you enable this service, and then here's a Hello World program, and next thing you know, they set you loose. And if you want to get down to it, you really have to dig through like their API reference, which is not user friendly.
Right. Well, that's like some of the things I'm trying to pick up from my work. You know, we're heavily into GitOps, using Jenkins and Ansible playbooks. I'm just trying to find some sort of primer that kind of leads me through the basics. How does it all interact? You know, how does Git and Jenkins and Ansible all work together? How do I take some code I wrote and put in Git, use Jenkins to deploy it, and have it run the Ansible playbook I need to run? How do I do that? You know, it's just trying to find good documentation on that. Now, granted, sometime right now, it's also for me time. It's like I get off work. What do I want to do? I don't want to fucking do this shit.
You don't want to read the Jenkins pipeline syntax page?
No, I do not. You know, so and it's just, you know, and I'm hoping at some point they do some of that at work, because you know, there's a lot of guys that are really smart with this shit that I work with, and most of them aren't on my team, you know, but it's, you know, and then of course, how does AWS tie in all that as well? Like, we just had this big, I'll call it a patching party Sunday, where we basically, it was kind of all hands on deck, you know, because it's the first time we were running this automation, all right, and it was for non-prod. And basically the goal was we'd use a SSAV, we call it, is version 2 of stop start architecture that they're setting up. So basically what the goal is, you run the stop part of the stop start, do your patching with for the Windows boxes, this IBM Big Time, or I forget the Windows patching facility there, but it's not standard Windows patching, which kind of wish it was, but it's anyway. Big Fix, IBM Big Fix.
Is this an IBM product?
It's an IBM product, yeah. And that's how we manage all the patches from everything from our laptops to servers. All right. Even our client servers are on the AWS are managed with a Big Fix. So that then once the patches are done, run the second part of the SSA, the startup, which is designed to boot, per the client, it's designed to boot the applications up in the right order. For example, it's got a tier, different tiers. Like tier one is going to have all the SQL database servers that have to come up and have to be up available before the rest of the other servers can come up. Then it'll bring up the application servers. Then it'll bring up the tier three servers, which will bring up all the web interfaces to it and all that. And then after all that's done, at some point it's supposed to bring up all the background processes that should be running in the application, like a garbage collection process, and something we call process handler, which is essentially a job scheduler. It's tied into the application itself. Then EDX is also brought up. EDX is a trigger based, like whenever data changes in the ERP, it'll create a transaction that sends it on to other applications, maybe via Rabbit in the background or whatever. So, the whole thing was designed to start up everything. It was all kicked off with Jenkins, the Jenkins pipeline. And it's like, I'm trying to figure out how does that freaking work, you know? I would say most of it worked. You know, the only thing that we discovered was that, like, for some reason, somebody had hard coded a version into the script instead of using the environment variable that's already on each server. So it went to go start up a unity of service, and that didn't start up because they were looking for the latest version, which is 8.2 something, and these particular servers had 8.1 something. And if they'd used the environment variable in that playbook, it would have brought up the database correctly. So because that database did not come up, then all the other processes in the pipeline failed. So because they all depend on that.
Who dropped the ball, Joel? Who dropped the ball?
I don't know, man. Well, actually, we had somebody who was helping us. It probably doesn't have as much background in the application as I or a lot of my teammates do. So, but it's an iteration thing. So they're, you know, they're going to do we're going to do a production run sometime in September. Although I'm an affinity admin. So basically they took the senior level folks like myself, and we each have I have a list of 11 clients that are my clients. I'm their affinity admin. I'm the one that supposed to be familiar with everything in their environment, from all the third party stuff to the other, the day to day. And, at least that's the way it's supposed to be. It's getting that way. You know, I'm starting to learn more about each of my clients, as time goes on. But, in any event, they,
I have a question for you, Joel.
Yeah. Yes,
have
sir.
Have you found the little help feature inside of the Jenkins?
I actually haven't looked at Jenkins for more than 15 minutes because I've had so much other shit to do.
But they have this if you were working in the UI in Jenkins, like to test stuff out, there is a little help feature in there. I know it's in the pipeline stuff.
Yeah.
And it's got a drop down list of, it says, what do you want to do? Like, do you want to run a job or connect to GitHub or like a whole list, like do a Maven build, all these things, and you click on that thing and it brings the code right in, and it asks, well, it gives you this little interface for you to fill in certain parameters or add parameters to it, and then it writes the code right into the window so you can see
cool
how it's supposed to be written. That is a pretty cool feature. Now, it's neat to figure certain things out, but once you get beyond, like, if you read the Jenkins like pipeline syntax web documentation on the web, and they give you like a dozen or so commands for working with a bunch of different things, like how to write files, how to read files, how to work with YAML, JSON, all these different things, it's really helpful. But what I find is missing is that gap between that basic level information and putting things together and then the rest of the world. Like, I take a look at some of the stuff that people I work with have written, and I'm like, how the hell did you figure that out? I don't even know how this is even working. I'm not even sure it does work, right? But it looks very impressive, and it supposedly works because they're using it somewhere else, but not on our stuff. And I'm like, there's that. Then there's like Groovy documentation, which doesn't work in Jenkins, but Jenkins uses Groovy. But what version of Groovy, like Jenkins Groovy, is not 100% like compatible with the Groovy documentation that you see out there on a regular basis for figuring this. It's something.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, and then eventually we're going to start adding Kubernetes to the mix as well. So I mean, which that can leverage quite a bit. Be nice to do that, and then hopefully.
Are you going to be building your own containers?
Probably not myself necessarily. I mean, I might be helping to build them, but
I mean, it's really simple to build a container.
Yeah, of course it is, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also really simple to just grab a container out there. I mean,
that too. I mean, yeah, you know, see, and that's. And see, that's kind of
careful security,
sorry, right? In certain parts, like there's basically multiple different ERP systems that our company has. The two primaries are our colleague, which is where I work, and the other is Banner. And these are ERP systems with SIS stuff, SIS student information system built into it. It's how the students register and sign up for classes and payroll gets paid and all that jazz. So, but parts of our architecture are similar. Like, for example, we both use Apache Tomcat, although we've got a limited life. Our application that runs under Apache Tomcat is being sunsetted, thankfully, being replaced by the Microsoft stack that runs our self-service and API. So eventually that will go away. But the way we interact...
Wait, so you're replacing you're replacing Apache Tomcat with Microsoft services?
Yeah, yeah.
Boo!
Microsoft Foundation classes, yes. So, there's a lot of other stuff built into the... Like, there's jQuery built into it as well. There's just a whole bunch of mishmash of stuff in self-service. But in the end run, too, that's the other thing, too. We also enabled... And I don't think it's enabled for our web browser pieces, but we have our own theme engine. So basically, it's a cloud-based theme engine that clients can just go to a website, say I want all of our applications to look like this. Whether it's the employee UI or the self-service pieces for the students, it's all going to have the same theme across the board. And it's cloud-based. And you actually have to activate it. You have to put an API key into the self-service sites and stuff. But once that's done, we don't have to worry about the theming. So not that we do, because we don't. We basically have a way that if they don't have the theme engine, we could kind of transfer the theme from non-prod to production somehow. And it's all manual right now, but that's one of the big things there, is just to work more automation in that, more of what they call it, what, a farm, I think, versus your servers being pets, you know?
Cattle versus pets.
Thank you. I was trying to think of the words. So, because at this time of night, I have problem with words. So, but that's, you know, kind of where we're working towards. And gosh, I've been learning something new almost every day this week. You know, from how the Elastic load balancers work in Amazon, the difference between that and the Elastic IPs, which don't change. We had a client or two had that problem. We got to tell them, well, Elastic load balancers are going to change their IP addresses on the load balancer from time to time. It's just the way it is. So you have to open up your network to this entire block of addresses, and they don't want to do that. but we're getting there. I mean, it's definitely been a great week. Oh, and I had learned one thing I learned how to do this week is I learned how to install a SharePoint Utility Update. that was fun. But it wasn't hard. It's different. We had to stop all of the services in SharePoint first, and then once that was done, then we ran the update in and then start all the services back up and then apply the update. So, we had to do that because there's a bug with some of the redirects in the SharePoint portal were not working properly because of Google updated Chrome. So, and we're kind of, you know, you talk about that, you know, what's the most popular browser now by far? Google Chrome or the Chrome engine, you know, Chromium.
Yeah, I think that has the lion's share.
For sure. I mean, even more than Firefox. Firefox is that's in danger of being an also ran almost nowadays. It's not as far back as like say something like Opera or even worse, Microsoft Edge. Microsoft Edge, which is now Chrome has the same engine as Chromium. So,
well, according to this one I'm looking at, it says Chrome was like 65%, Safari 16, Firefox.
Yeah. So the only reason Safari is that high is because of iOS devices.
Oh, okay. So I was looking at that. That was overall, but desktop browser market share is 69 Chrome, 8 Firefox, 8 Safari. This is just this one site.
It hasn't been that high for any one browser in a long time.
That's what net market share says. Well, I don't want to look at the 5 month. Yeah, Chrome.
By month.
Chrome is the big one. Yeah.
Chrome.
Yeah, I would love. That's one of the things that I find, like, with the job that I do, and maybe you guys find the same thing, is I'm not what it's called, like, DevOps, and you straddle between development and operations.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you become like more of like a polyglot in computer languages. Yep. And technologies and stuff. It's hard to get
it
mastery
is.
Over any single technology because you're constantly shifting around, which is great. Yep. In its own right, but by the time you, like, really dig in, like, I was learning Node.js for a while and I was starting to get that, and then I haven't touched, like, working in that kind of that much, you know, and I was on Yep. Couchbase for a long time. And then
YAML?
Yeah, then it's like writing YAML for a while and Yep. working with that, and then doing Jenkins stuff, and then trying to get Sumo Logic and, you know, different and New Relic and their languages and different scripting stuff that they use there. And it's like, if you don't do it all the time, you start to lose it. So if you shift off to something else and then you come back, it's not as steep of a learning curve,
right.
But you never really get that, like, I want to be a master and a wizard at it.
Mm-hmm.
As easily. It takes us a lot.
That's like in my case, we're going to have, let's see, we have Corn Shell, we have PowerShell, YAML.
Corn Shell, man. Holy
Ansible.
Crap.
Yeah, Corn Shell. Corn Shell's very good. A lot of people don't realize how much stuff that's built into Corn. Like, a lot of the basics for LS is built into Corn Shell. I believe it's actually built into Corn. I have to look and see. There was a list at some point of all the different things that are built into Corn Shell. But one of the reasons why the Unisys, especially like the AIX, Solaris was C Shell for a long time, but you can still use Corn there. But AIX is one of the ones that started, you know, where Corn Shell was pretty much the default shell. That shell I took a class on it, like, it's been over 10 years ago now. We actually, during the class, we had some really good instructors. You know, they're both older than anybody in the room, but that's okay. Because they've been doing Unix for far longer than probably you or I have been living. But they did some demonstrations that showed, well, the differences between Bash and Corn. And it was all speed, because Corn has all this stuff built into it. Corn was faster than Bash, believe it or not. So I need to go find the whole list at some point of how many things are built into Corn Shell that traditionally are not in, that are just part of the GNU stack. So
my only issue again with using different shells like Corn, I've used Corn in the past, TCH or TC. SH, tickle, fish. Fish is always touted as a great shell. I've used it just a little bit. The only problem I have is like, if you switch around to a bunch of different systems, 9 times out of 10, Bash is what's going to be available, right?
True.
And
well, just like VI or Vim's going to be available.
Yeah, so while I find those other shells interesting, it's just that I would suffer that same penalty of like jumping around the different technologies all the time. Mm-hmm. If I'm not using it on a regular basis, I would lose it. And then it's like, if I had the option between Bash and Corn or Fish, I would probably still stick with Bash because, you know, just like VI, it's everywhere.
Yep. Well, it's actually probably better in most cases. The one that's almost everywhere is just this plain old Born shell, not the Born Again shell, which is Bash, Born
shell. I mean, I find that a lot with containers, especially very slim containers, have just Born shell, not a full Bash. Bash shell. So you really don't notice much of a difference. Minimal things that you would need to do.
Nope.
But if I got onto a container and it dumped me into a seashell, that would be a completely different experience, you know?
Right. I hate seashell. I remember the first time I had to learn how seashells just feels like it feels so backwards almost, you know what I mean? The first time I ever used seashell was we had these Xerox printers that basically used the Solaris box to run them. That was their controller. And I had to use that to navigate the file system and stuff on there to help put documents and stuff on it. And boy, was that a pain in the ass. It's like working in CDE versus a modern desktop like Unity.
CDE.
A common desktop environment.
Is that still around?
I'm sure AIX still uses it in the workstation mode, but even there, like if you look on the hardware management console for AIX machines or a power-based hardware, that's almost definitely going to be Fluxbox running on top of that. And it's Linux too, versus AIX being used for the hardware management console. The hardware management console, if you're unfamiliar with that kind of a concept, the bigger IBM Power machines, they're going to have like the ability to do kind of virtualization, like you can do with VMware and other virtualization kind of technologies. It's not at all like Kubernetes or anything like that. It's more like a VM solution. So you can, like, I can do a partition or logical partition, which would have one AIX system in it. Another on the same machine, I can have an LPAR with a Linux host in it running, say, Debian or trying to think who's left running on Power, SUSE maybe, you know. So, and they can go down to micro steps in the how much CPU cores can go back, and you can also set up loading so that when a load goes up on one of the logical partitions, it will depending on where its weight is in the whole server, if it has a higher priority over, say, your print server, then the one with the higher priority is going to grab CPU from the print server because the print server doesn't need as much. You know what I mean? So it can vary the amount of CPUs logically, kind of like what would happen in AWS in the cloud, you know. So, like we have in our case, we have a dedicated host that has multiple hosts running on top of that. So, but it's that's all run and controlled by hardware management console. That's basically a Linux box that talks directly to the hardware, to the service processors on the power machine. So, and I don't think they have anything like that in Intel hardware yet, or at all. But DevOps for me, and with my original background coming from mainframe operations, DevOps feels a lot like just mainframe operations, where we had GCL that we would write, job control language, basically would control. We could take programs that we didn't write and string them together with GCL and run them together. So it's very similar to that, in my opinion. It's a lot more complex, a lot more flexible, but it's very similar. It's where they get ops from GitOps, you know, or the ops and DevOps. So there you go. Hey, Greybeard, remember mentioned BusyBox. I think BusyBox, I think that's what my Nokia N810 runs for its default shell, I think.
BusyBox.
I remember back in the day where before GPotter had a port to that, where I was using BashPotter on it to grab my podcast. Man, it's so weird. I went to, you know, because of this virus, just kind of move off of tech for a little bit. I just went to, normally in October every year we go down to the Circleville Pumpkin Show, but it's been canceled because of the pandemic. So here I am sitting in August and I'm going on there. It says 427 days until the Pumpkin Show because it's not going to happen this year. Sucks.
Drama.
I have to make my own pumpkin stuff this year. That, and I'm not opposed to that. I do that. They actually have good recipes on their website for a lot of their things, but there was just nothing like the walking around the small town Ohio, Circleville, Ohio. And they have there's their share of carnival crap there, you know, but it's like there was artisans and stuff that would set up booths. Like I have a guy that guy that used to go to my church, he and his wife would set up a booth there. They'd order in these oysters, and you can sit there and pry them open. If you have a pearl in them, they'll put the pearl in a setting for you right there at the show, and things like that. So, but and that just reminds me too. I need to. I want to contact the show down there and see if I can find a way that I can send a check down to some of the vendors that I would normally visit when I'm down there. And I'm still going to make a trip down there and get me some pumpkin donuts at the bakery down there, which are just phenomenal. Just because I don't want... It's going to suck because that community just depended so much. That was their time. That was like their Black Friday, dude. And now it's not happening. It sucks.
Did you say you watched the first two episodes of High Score?
Yeah, High Score. It's a documentary series on video games. Done in the same manner as The Toys That Made Us.
I like that show, The Toys That Made Us.
So in the first episode was all about Space Invaders, Pac-Man, Missile Command.
The Atari 2600 stuff and the arcade games?
I don't know. They didn't really talk too much about that. I'm just trying. Okay, Netflix, I don't want to play it. Thank you. I just want to bring up the list of episodes. So basically, the first episode was all about Space Invaders, Pac-Man, and how Space Invaders' real inspiration was Atari Breakout. Because it marches down the screen just like Breakout does. All right. But that one actually had the guy who developed Space Invaders. And he pulls out this really crusty notebook and flips through it. And he has the original sketches that he then converted the sketches into blocks for making the characters in Space Invaders. So it was just really cool to see that. And I went all the way through that. And then episode 2 that I watched talks about Nintendo and how the first game that Nintendo launched in America was, what do you think it is, Dan?
Donkey Kong. Well, I was going to say, was it Donkey Kong that they launched in?
That's the first one that everyone knows and everyone remembers, but they actually shipped a different machine over here that sat in Nintendo of America's warehouse in Seattle and gathered dust until it wasn't Miyamoto that developed Donkey Kong. Well, actually, maybe it was Miyamoto. But until they developed Donkey Kong, because Nintendo just had a rough time trying to figure out how
it was captured. Miyamoto.
Yeah, was it Miyamoto? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And he actually was. They had lots of footage of Miyamoto in that episode as well too. But it basically talks about how Nintendo, basically, if it wasn't for Nintendo, we wouldn't have the video games that we have today. Because it was in 1983, when right around the time E.T. came out, and a lot of people blame E.T. on the Atari 2600 for destroying the video game market because it was awful. For a lot of people, it was awful. I actually liked it. I liked the E.T. game.
I thought E.T. was a piece of crap.
I haven't watched it yet, but episode 3 is about role-playing games. So it goes on through. It, like I said, it's done very much in the style of The Toys That Made Us. So if you like that series, you'll like this. And I could see this going for longer, too. And I'm going to get a whole bunch of stuff out of this. Like there's an episode all on fighting games like Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat. One on Sega Genesis. Looks like one on Sega Genesis. And in the episode 6 talks about 3D, how 3D acceleration in 3D games like started like with like Star Fox on the Super Nintendo and stuff like that, you know, how they originally kind of grafted on and did. And see, a lot of people don't realize that too. With Super Nintendo, it's very common to add chips that would interact with the base CPU on the Super Nintendo to enhance the games. Like, for example, the Super FX chip that a lot of Super Nintendo games used. And that actually, even then, that wasn't a new thing. Atari did that. Well, not Atari directly, but some Atari games did that first. Pitfall 2 was one of the original ones that had like a coprocessor built onto the game cartridge so that it can have different sounds. But,
Joe.
And, in the first episode too, they also mentioned the Channel F, which was the first home console that had cartridges, developed by a black man, believe it or not. I'm trying to remember what his name was. I have to go back to the notes, but it was, they had a segment on that that talked about him.
Joe.
But you'll like it.
Joe.
I'm here.
Did you play the role-playing, the Dungeons & Dragons role-playing games on the computer?
I think I did.
That's what SSI, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, SSI.
On emulation, though, it's been so long. Yeah, I was actually looking to see if they were still out there. I just hadn't picked them up recently to play them. But yeah, that was something very similar.
I always did the same strategy on that. It's all my characters attack one guy until he's dead, and then move on to the next one until he's dead. But I'm sorry, go ahead. You were about to say.
I'm thinking of an older game then, but if you're talking about the Icewind Dale games, or
there was holy crap, I know the one that sticks out in my head the most was Spelljammer. There was
I don't think I ever played Spelljammer.
There was Spelljammer, then there was a lot of Pool of Radiance. I remember playing Pool of Radiance. Eye of the Beholder. I think Secret of the Silver Blades. I don't know if I ever... So,
Pool of Radiance looks familiar.
Yeah, these were really...
What was that last one?
Secret of the Silver Blades. I'm trying to remember whether I played any of the Dragonlance ones that were in.
They're a little bit newer than this, but not by a whole lot. But yeah, the Baldur's Gate and the Icewind Dale book are games. Those I did play.
Well, wait, the Baldur's Gate... I want to make sure. I'm trying to see how many Baldur's Gates there was. Oh, I'm just looking at this.
Baldur's Gate. What? That's actually isn't Baldur's Gate. What was Skyrim a part of? Wasn't that part of Baldur's Gate? I thought.
No, that Baldur's Gate was Dungeons and Dragons. Skyrim is like Oblivion.
Ah, okay.
And there's something before Oblivion. I can't remember what it was. You know what? So Baldur's Gate is not the ones that I'm thinking of lumped into that, because that was almost a decade later. The ones I'm talking about were like early, like late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, hey. Like I said, the Baldur's Gate and the Icewind Dale stuff was newer.
Here you go. But not by Forgotten like a Realms.
Lot. Yeah.
The Forgotten Realms, the Archives Collection 2 on Good Old Games.
Baldur's Gate came out in 1998.
Yeah. So, like, Spelljammer Pirates of Realm Space was the one that I remember playing the hell out of. Was 1992. That was Cybertech Systems, not SSI.
Yep. Yeah, well, if you look on GOG.com, Good Old Games. Forgotten Realms, the Archives Collection 2 is $9.99, and it includes some of the games you just talked about.
Let me look at that. They play under DOSBox, right? GOG.
This works on Windows 7, 8, 10, Linux, and Mac 10.
Ooh.
Dan's going to spend $10.
Let's see, Forgotten Realms of Collection. You're right, Joel. Look at this. What do you
How
get?
Much is it?
$10.
$9.99. You get Eye of the Beholder, Eye of the Beholder 2, Eye of the Beholder 3. Wait, that's...
8 games.
Where's the other 8 games? Wait, am I looking at the wrong one?
Well, you might be looking at Collection 1, but in Collection 2, you have Pool of Radiance, Curse of the Azure Bond, Hillsfire, Secret of the Silver Blade, Pools of Darkness, Gateway to the Savage Frontier, Treasures of the Savage Frontier, Forgotten Realms, Unlimited Adventures.
Look at that. Collection 2 looks like it's...
They actually have 1, 2, and 3, as in 3 different collections.
Where's 3? What's on 3? 3 is only $5.99.
And they're, oh wow, and they're all playable on Linux too, by the way.
Dungeon Hack. Oh, look at that. There's only 2 games.
DOSBox built in.
That's why it's only $5. I bet you that's probably what it is.
I'm pretty sure it's... You would need... I can't imagine that these are running under anything but DOSBox.
Yeah, and then the first collection, Eye of the Beholder, all three, yeah. Eye of the Beholder.
This says in there, in the requirements, this game is powered by DOSBox.
Okay, that's what it is.
I'm looking, and yeah, that Archives collection for $9.99 only has those 3 games.
The first one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, do you know, yeah, they got a bunch of collections. There's the Kryn series, Ravenloft series, Dark Sun series. They're like all $9.99, so the Kryn series has Champions of Kryn, Dark Death Knights of Kryn, Dark Queen of Kryn. Oh, there's 3 games.
I might have to pick up the Space Quest series.
Okay, yeah, the second one does have a lot. I mean, Unlimited Adventures, Treasures of the Savage Frontier, Gateway to the Savage Frontier, Pools, Secrets of the Silver Blades, Ilsfar, Curse of the Azurbonds, Pool of Radiance. What's in the third one?
Third one only has 2 games because it's $5.99.
Ah, bummer. I'm looking at Good Old Games has the Space Quest series as well, both in 2 different collections, 1, 2, 3, and 1, and 4, 5, and 6 in another. Each one's only like $10, but they only work on Windows. I loved Space Quest. Was fun.
I don't know if I ever played Space Quest. That's...
Yeah, you were a janitor? On a starship? Yes. Roger Wilco.
This looks somewhat familiar.
One of the original Sierra games.
No, they don't have Spelljammer. Oh well.
My favorite Space Quests were probably the first 2, and then 4 was really good.
You know what you can get, Joe? You really want to go old school, get Zork trilogy.
I've played the first Zork.
Did you like it?
Well, I've played that type of game before. I can't remember the names of the other ones. Those text-based...
Infocom games.
Infocom games. I have played some, and then that, you know, kind of led me into...
That reminds
MUDs.
Me.
Yes, Joel. That kind of led me into MUDs. And I played a lot of that in high school.
That's one of the games I wanted to play again. It's called The Crescent Hawk's Revenge.
I have never heard of that.
It was a Mech Warrior game.
Well, I never got into Mech Warrior stuff. What were you? Sorry, Joe. I didn't mean to cut you.
Oh, no worries. I think the MUD that I used to play is still around. Madeavia.com. My character probably isn't there anymore, but...
How do you know?
I don't know.
You should log in and find out.
I would have to, set up Telnet and run it.
Actually, that would be... Battletech, technically, is what the Crescent House Revenge is. It wasn't one. It was more of strategy game than it was actually piloting a mech like you did a Mech Warrior. It's very similar. To me, it felt a lot like kind of like what's the StarCraft? Kind of like that. Kind of felt like that to me. More RPG though.
I put a link in for that mod that I used to play that's still around. And for people that don't know, MUD is a multi-user dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
And the precursor to the MMORPG.
Yep. To me nowadays, though, I don't think... I mean, video games are still fun. But in certain cases, like, especially, like, not so much, you know, PC games. But, like, arcade games are all very, very formulaic. In that it's formulaic to the point where basically a lot of the driving games you see at a place like Dave and Buster's are the same game, but with just different skins on them. Different map here and there, you know. But as you drive it and you play the game, it just feels exactly the same. And it's boring.
I have a question for you, Joe.
Sure.
So I'm looking at the world and the city of Medivia. Is that how it's pronounced? Medivia?
I could, you know, I've only ever read it myself, but I think it's Medievia.
Okay, Medievia. And it says there are 2,130 rooms, but then it says lifespan 3 minutes. What does that mean? What's lifespan?
Well, I'm sure it's changed since I was playing it in the 90s. But where does it say that? In How to Play or the World? Okay, the world.
It's in the world. It just says, like, lifespan. And I was like, what?
I clicked on the world. Features of Medievia? No.
Yeah, areas of the game. I went down
Medievia
to...
maps. Which one?
I thought it was in the world.
Yeah, well, when I click on the world, I see more stuff come up. Features of Medievia,
areas of the game, areas of Medievia, and then I clicked on the first one, which was the cities of Medievia, and it said lifespan 3 minutes.
Oh, how long you're likely to live?
Really? And that's levels 1 to 10. Hmm.
Either that or how long it takes to for everything to respawn.
Oh, man. You know, they have a glossary, but they don't say what lifespan is.
Yeah. If I had more hours in the day, I would try to add playing this again.
Oh, this looks like... This looks like NetHack almost, but
yeah, it's a
more...
a completely text-based game. I mean, there is some imagery as you wander around. They use different colored characters in a grouping to give you an idea of terrain.
Because I'm looking at the font. It says to download the fonts to play.
Yeah, because you do need the colored fonts, and it also depends on, you know, it used to be that you could download it all as a package, and it would just all come together in one Telnet tool. And yes, the protocol is Telnet.
You know what I like about this? When you go to click on play now, you have documentation for the Linux platform.
Yep. And I guess because nobody really uses Telnet anymore, they are using these prepackaged applications that do Telnet. Now, I'm sure you can still manually install Telnet and then do the whole Telnet address port, but you might miss out on some of the fonts, as it were.
You talk about MUDs, it just reminds me of door games on the BBSs.
Back in the day, huh?
Trade Wars, was it Trade War, was it 2002? I can't remember.
What was 2002?
Yeah, Trade Wars 2002 was one of those BBS games. Oh my gosh, can you play it online now?
I think so. You know what?
TradeWars.com exists.
What was his name? John Watson was running a BBS, and I think he was playing some games. I can't remember. Had some games on there. I'm not sure if Trade Wars was one of them.
I used to play it. I was horrible at it.
Oh, look at that, Joe. I could install Tintin++ out of the repository on my Chromebook.
They did say that it was an older version, but yeah, you can get it from the repo.
Look at that. It's there. I'm sure it's in Fedora, too. But every time I freaking run DNF search, I got to update my Fedora cache.
And I'm looking for instructions on running Tintin.
Oh, I wonder how big it is.
It didn't seem very big. 171 kilobytes.
Yeah, you're right. It's not that big. So it's what? Well, what? What's the? What is Tintin's command?
That's what I'm looking for.
Because I just installed it and it's there, but I don't have like.
How do you kick it off? It doesn't show up in the. Is .tt++ command file?
Oh, tt++.
tt++.
No, how do I get out of it? I started it, and now I can't get out of it.
Exit. Nope, that didn't do it.
Wait. What is it?
Pound quit. Nope.
Well, wait. Oh, session.
Oh, my old character is still here.
Really? It's like you never left.
Right. Except, yeah. Level 12 thief.
Yeah, I think after I move, I'm gonna work on trying to build me a game rig.
Oh, I'm in, Joe. I'm in.
Did you create a new character yet?
I'm creating one now.
Anywho.
Ah, the name only consists of letters. Why can't I have numbers? What's your character's name, Joe?
NephrusDF. It's NEPHRUSDF.
There we go. Nobody has this name. Oh, my name's too long. Jeez.
What is this? Apple, Microsoft file systems? Jeez.
Yeah, there we go.
You guys hear about the whole Epic Games thing with Apple?
Oh, you mean the one
with Fortnite and
they
charge. Apple takes 30%.
Apple's not the only one. Google does too.
That's fucking insane, man. It's fucking robbery. That's like Monopoly type shit. Honestly.
Can't
blame them for wanting to keep their own money.
Well, the other thing I don't get here is one of my favorite PC game series from the original all the way up through, I think I had MechWarrior 4 at one point, but which was, believe it or not, made by Microsoft. But the MechWarrior series, the current one is MechWarrior 5 Mercenaries, and it's only available on the Epic Games Store, which sucks. Not on Steam, not on CD, of course.
Yeah, my younger buddy plays Fortnite, and he's telling me what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
They were going back and forth. Epic made a goof of a 1984 Apple commercial.
Right. Now that's the one neat thing with the MechWarrior series is they actually aren't staying in one era of the BattleTech universe. In fact, the latest game actually goes back to one of the Succession Wars when they had the Inner Sphere. If you aren't familiar with the universe, basically the center of all of the what they call the Inner Sphere is Earth. All right, and then over the years, the Star League was formed, and at some point, the main leader of the Star League's battle mech army, Alexander Kerensky, decided he had had enough of the infighting, and he took all of the Star League's mech warriors out to the outer sphere, out beyond the outer rim of the galaxy, the Inner Sphere broke into like different houses and what they called Succession Wars and stuff like that. So like you had one that was mostly Asian, because it was called Karita. Then there was a Steiner and Davio and so on and so forth. There's just a real deep culture, deep story to all of it. And then like MechWarrior 2, when that game came out in 1995, surrounds when Kerensky's people who came from the MechWarriors that left the Inner Sphere formed what they call clans, and the clans came back to take the Inner Sphere. And that's what the MechWarrior 2 came, you know, basically that's its time period. And this all comes from the original board game back in the day. And there's a role-playing game called MechWarrior associated with it, very similar to Dungeons & Dragons, just a lot less of the fantasy stuff in it. More science fiction. But they even have books written on it, and there was a cartoon series at one point. Whew, $60.
For what?
The top level of MechWarrior 5 Mercenaries is $60 on Epic Games. The mod editor is free, though. I don't know. I have to look and see what kind of specs you really need to run that game. I don't think any of my machines have that. Hence me wanting to build a game system. See, minimum specs. Of course, you have to have Windows 8.1 or 10. It needs a Core i3 7100. It recommends a NVIDIA GeForce GTX 770 GPU minimum. Nothing I have has that. So, yeah. That's one nice thing with console games. You just go buy the console and, you know, it'll just work. Like on the Switch.
Yeah. That is true. You have that advantage in a console. Yep.
Well, now it seems to be even popular. Like, go to the store, you can get for like $20, $30, you can get those little emulation consoles, which already have all the ROMs on it.
I don't know if I would do that. I think it's kind of expensive. You mean the kind that... Can you put more on there, or are you just limited to what?
Well, it depends. There's a couple that you can. I know that. I'm trying to remember the one I saw a video on. Not the GPD-2X or whatever you call it.
What the hell did I just pull down, Joe?
I don't know.
What's the name of the font file? Medivia. Where did it go? Where's my downloads?
I'm just using the stock stuff that was included in Tintin right now.
Yeah, but I want it to look pretty like it does on the website. Because that's all that matters, right?
Uh-huh.
Where does Chrome OS downloaded shit to?
Now, Lynch is interesting. It's on Amazon. It's on Prime. Something called the Huasita handheld video game console. Retro. It's got like a Wish kind of sounding product name. It says the whole thing is Huasita handheld video game console, retro video game console, 4.3-inch HD screen, classic game console, portable video game, nostalgic game console for children and adults. This is top-selling handheld games console, retro games console, have variety of classic games. You can also download games in related formats. Now I'm trying to fit. Okay, it says 8 building simulators. Our products support arcade, NES, GBA, as in Game Boy Advance, Game Boy Color, Game Boy. What's SFC? Super Famicom and Famicom.
All right, it's getting late, guys.
It is.
Was it that time already?
It is.
It's almost 10 o'clock.
Huh.
I might have to give me one of these things. Someone for $40, that's not too bad.
Oh, that's how you do it. How simple is that? You mark the file, mark the folder, share with Linux. I don't even know where the hell I'm supposed to put this font. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Joe.
Yeah, y'all have fun.
All right. What do we got here? What do we got? Oh, we got it. Start wrapping this show up with our promos. Where you at this week, Joe?
Oh, this week got the Linux Lugcast coming out on, well, we're recording on Friday. It should be out on Friday too. And then we're recording the Mintcast on Sunday.
All right. All right, as always, I'd like to thank our longtime listener, Peter64, who apparently listens to every show. So good on him. Down under thunder.
Get your beetroot burger, mate.
That's it. All right, I'm going to play us out. Thank you, everybody. You have a good week. Stay safe. Here are your promos.
Yeah. Hi, folks. This is Chatter. Kate Wisher, Honky Magoo, 5150, and I have started a new podcast. Yeah, I know we should have gotten Brian Lunduke to do the voiceover, but he wanted a script, and none of us are any good at scripting language. Anyway, it's Linux Lugcast. We're at linuxlugcast.com, IRC channel, pound Linux Lugcast on Freenode. We record on the first and third Fridays of the month, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 0200 UTC. We talk about things we've tried, things we got to work, things we failed to get working, things we built, and things we broke. Email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com, and if we don't know the answer, we'll just tell you to install Arch. That's a joke, son. So join us as we stifle the outcry of voices everywhere for another Linux podcast.
Oh my God, it's Hacker
Public Radio. Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
Hello. My name is Matt, and I've started a new podcast called LibreQuest. I talk about Linux and general technical topics. To get the show, visit LibreQuest.org.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up.
Daddy has a gun!
It's over.
Well, you were making Egg Foo Young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
Yeah.
Yeah, check that thing out, Dan. That's pretty neat looking for $40.
Where'd you put it?
Mumble chat.
The Hawasita handheld one?
Yep. I think some also call it the X1, I think. I don't know.
Huh. Hello. Interesting. Why does it only have three reviews, like 3 stars?
3.2 out of 5. I guess it might be from some people that buy it and think, oh, it's already got games on it, and which I think it does have some.
Huh.
That's not the only one that's out there. There's some others out there too, but they all kind of look like. Actually, I saw them. If you ever watch Ashen's video YouTube channel, he had one that literally looked exactly like a Nintendo Switch, but you couldn't take off the Joy-Cons. But it looked exactly like it.
Huh. It looks very tempting.
For $40, yeah. Because it's like, I've always wanted the GPD XD or the XD2, but I can't justify spending that much money on those.
GPDs are cool.
The only downside is reading the reviews, it seems like whatever emulator they have on there does not work with arcade games.
It doesn't work with MAME? Hmm.
Oh. Oh, that's a PlayStation Portable for $112. I'm like, there's a bunch of other ones that are around the same price range. Oh, wait, what's this one? This looks like the same one under a different name.
Oh, like the JXD.
Oh, wait, this one. All right, let me. It's got one review, I think. No customer reviews. Haha, that sucks. This one says it supports arcade games, but I don't. Nobody has it. Don't hesitate. This is the best holiday gift for friends. Many super classic games, including Super Mario, Contra, Tetris, and other classic FC games.
It's $42.99.
The Famicom.
Double Rocker handheld game console. So support arcade games, GBA, Super Famicom, Game Boy, I guess GBS? What's GBS? Game Boy, I don't know, Game Boy Advance, Game Boy S, Game Boy and Famicom games. All right, I gotta stop the recording. Oh, that's all right. I mean, I'd really be interested in hearing your perspective on some of those things, because I think we kind of have almost a decade apart of that stuff.
Probably. Maybe a little further, because I really didn't get into it until like the 00s.
To hell with Cherry Hill Tony.
Right.
Oh. Do you know Cherry Hill Tony?
He keeps showing up on all the podcasts, but he never talks. But one time on the Linux Lugcast, he didn't have a headset, and we never heard him talk because we all ended up having to mute him because speakers to microphone.
I thought you knew Cherry Hill Tony. Like, every time I see Cherry Hill Tony, I keep thinking, like, I'm really curious as to where Cherry Hill is.
Because South Jersey, on the side from Philly.
Is that it? Is that where he's from, or is that another Cherry Hill?
That's the only Cherry Hill I know.
That's the same one I know, and I was just curious if that's Cherry Hill, if he's from that area. Dun, 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 dun.
How's it going?
All right, how are you doing, man?
I'm good.
So now we can ask Pat about RPGs.
I wish. I could tell you about $1,400 cell phones at the T-Mobile store.
You bought one?
You kidding me?
I didn't think so. What cell phone were you looking at? It was 1400.
Well, we can talk about it once the show starts.
Okay.
And you are talking about tabletop RPG, right?
Yeah. I wish. I've shot some machine guns. I've shot a saw. I've shot a Nagav.
Okay, no. See, you're saying RPG as in rocket-propelled grenade. We're saying tabletop.
Oh, role-playing game. Yeah, it's a role-playing game.
And I actually have shot RPG, so.
Yeah,
D&D, Dungeons
and Dragons.
And that's the end of Cherry Hill Tone.
Yeah,
it sounds like he has either his
speakers and the microphone on the side of his laptop.
Probably what it is, laptop.
But you never played any RPGs, Pat?
I did. I played D&D. I forgot what else. I played a few. Not a ton. I haven't done it in a long time, but sure. Back in the day, yeah.
That's what we were talking about, back in the day.
Yeah.
And there's Joel.
Going to talk about his house. See, Pat.
He'll take over the show again.
Nice house.
Was good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Movie day has opened up over here. They had a special 15-cent movie. They sold out with
everything. Woohoo!
15-cent movies at the just movie where theater. I wanna
go. Yes, yes. It wasn't like, you know, latest or greatest, but they had some. They had like Sonic the Hedgehog. They had like Black Panther. A few other ones. Half capacity, they're going.
Yeah, I think I'll stay home and not go to the movie theater.
I don't have a problem though. I've been going to church for a month, no problem.
No, I just don't want to watch anything they have, even at 15 cents.
You can watch Black Panther before you trip on Wakanda.
And I've been busy cleaning a bathroom because the realtor's coming tomorrow. Because he's official, we're going to be listing within the next 21 days. And we assigned the build contract. Woohoo.
When do they expect the build to be completed?
Expected closing right now, actually 6 months, February. But I don't know about that. We'll see what happens.
Wait, 6 months you said?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that puts you in what, February?
Yeah, February.
Okay. When do they plan on starting the build, do you know?
Next week we go, we have, let's see, I am assuming till Monday probably to do any, like any physical changes, like if we wanted to say nix the bonus room or something like that. We have until, it's 7 days from the time we signed a build contract until the time where we can't make any like physical change like that. That doesn't mean like colors or anything like that. But then next Thursday we go to the design studio. I'm taking a half day off work. We're going to the design studio to pick the like flooring and colors and all that other stuff, you know.
But you don't know when they actually start the building of it.
No. And I'm suspecting February is overly optimistic because we went over there and they don't even have the road yet that they're building it on. They have none of the roads are complete.
Right, but are they doing building over there now?
I haven't been over there since last weekend. I assume they were probably working this weekend, working on leveling the grade. Starting to pour the streets and stuff.
Are they going to build the roads first, or do they just start building the houses they build the roads?
They have to build the roads first. Roads and if not all the road, like the utility lines, because the water and the sewer and electric are all underground, just like they are here. So they have to get all that in first as well, because they'll need all that there. But I'm assuming sometime this fall would be when ground would break. And I know from experience, it doesn't really, from the time they get the foundation poured and all that, you know, it could be a month before they actually start to do framing, depending on how long it takes them to get that poured. I've gone through this stuff before, so. But
I was going to say, I mean, if they could get the foundation poured by like October, and then start framing and everything, they should be able to not be that much impacted by weather.
Yeah. In December. I know that, well, depending on if we actually close in February, there will be no grass. It will just be dirt because they can't put grass down, the sod down too early. They can't really put the sod down till April or May, I think. So.
That's okay. You don't need grass.
Or you could just like concrete it over completely.
Well, actually, one thing I'm real happy with is we're going to have a concrete driveway versus an asphalt one, which I think concrete's a little bit more durable than asphalt.
I agree.
Oh, you're going to have to get a lawnmower, Joel. Do you have a lawnmower now?
I have a lawnmower now, but actually I won't need a lawnmower because the HOA takes care of that for us.
HOA does the mowing for you?
Absolutely.
And how much are you paying to the HOA a month?
It's a good question. I have to go back and look. It's not that much, though.
$300, $500
No, it's not even that high. Maybe it might be that a year. Maybe a little bit more. I don't know. But I
well,
mean,
if they're doing the lawn mowing for everybody,
mm-hmm.
that's not cheap.
Nope, but everyone pays into it, so I'm not, you know. I mean,
plus, is there a pool?
There's no pool, no.
Is there security?
No security. It's just lawn mowing. It's not a fenced-in community. No. It's not. Lawn mowing and snow removal.
Telling you how no. your life.
Well, I'm it's lawn saying. Mowing, snow removal, and kind of what Pat said. You know, like, oh, for example, okay. I can't put a pool up, I can't put a fence up. Not that
how
I want to
do
either of those.
How dare you put up a treehouse for you? You can't do anything.
But...
I don't
you
have
think
a kid.
It costs
he's 21
least...
now.
I'm just being an example.
Okay.
All right. So yeah, it don't it and I also have potential lines on outside the realtor. I haven't talked to her yet, but I got some potential lines on how we can get rid of this place. So
burn it to the ground. That,
that's a way. It's not the not, way. But, not the way. But,
not the way you want to do it.
No. No. I'm trying. One of the ways is I could basically avoid having to move twice. Most of the other ways, it's definitely we're going to have to go into an apartment first and then into a house. And if we do that, then probably just taking in there, just the minimal we need to survive. You know, so a lot of the stuff that a good chunk of my office, with exception of the laptops this desk I'm using right now, I would probably put the rest of it in storage for the most part. But it'll be an adventure, just like the first home was. I'm gonna have a screen room, Dan. That I'm looking forward to.
A screen room on the front or back?
It's in the back.
Okay.
It's in the back. Yeah.
Well, is that a porch or is it a screen room?
Screen. Like, well, it's more like a screen porch. So, like, there's no environmental controls out there, but it's all screened in and protected from the weather. You know, there's like eaves and stuff around the top. The roof of that, so when like it's not like the if it's raining, the rain's not gonna come pouring in through the screen,
right?
You know,
that's I wish I had a screen.
Yep, it's good. And there's like
a porch.
Yeah, outside the little outside that room, there's like a door that goes outside, and there's like a pad. I think there will be like a pad there, like where I could put my grill and stuff. You know. But like, you know, we're probably gonna end up like I got some stuff sitting like furniture sitting on my deck. I'm not taking it with me, and we're just gonna get some new stuff. You know, it'll actually be kind of nicer because I can get things like I can get like wicker stuff, and that looks really nice that would never survive outside, you know, in the rain and all that. So I can put that out there instead of like having to go and not to buy no stupid umbrella or anything like that, you know. Don't need it. Be out there. But it was kind of a tough choice between that and the other option was that could be a sunroom where that's more connected to the rest of the house. Like there's not a sliding door between it and the room. It's just kind of connected to the house. But I think it was a little bit more added a lot. I mean, it's just bad enough how much it's going to cost right now, but we're over three, so over 300,000. But that's a lot of house too. It's not what I would call a McMansion at all, but it is a nice house. So, the last place I'm ever going to move. I did that a lot when I was a kid. I have it when I was an adult. Actually, this house has been the longest I've lived at any address in my whole entire life. The one I'm sitting in. So.
All right. We gotta get the show rolling.
Yes, sir. I actually got a good show we can talk about on the show. It just hit Netflix this week.
Well, I think I know what you're talking about. Did it hit today?
It might have. I don't know. I've watched 2 episodes already.
Yeah, I got some good Netflix watching in.
Now, we must not be talking about the same show because I thought the show I'm thinking about hits today.
High Score?
Yeah. Is it already on?
Yeah, that's
on?
What I'm talking about. It's on, yeah.
Oh, I thought it was today that it hit. I would have watched it already.
Well, I did watch it today.
Oh, well, there we go. All right.
So, I watched the first episode at lunch and the second one after lunch. After work, I should say. But,
all right, let's just start off and talk about some tech stuff. Here we go.